Please be seated.
Sorry about the delay this morning. A misunderstanding between the registry and myself as to printing requirements. Anyway, any issues arising overnight? No issues. Very good. Ms. Baker Galloway, I see that Ben Farrell has filed evidence but has not attached the full set of provisions to his evidence but has just simply attached the stuff that he wants.
Already onto that, ma'am.
Good.
So, yep. You'll be able to read it in one place
one
by
place.
The end of today.
That's
yep.
all we need.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So that'll be done by the end of the day?
Yes.
All right, good.
Yep.
Not that I've read it. We've just eyeballed it and seen the problem. So we're with you, Mr. Page, and I think you're at paragraph 60.
Yes, I am. And so we were we were on the topic of the Galaxia's evidence and how that might be relevant to things you need to decide. The clash of evidence on Galaxia's between Dr. Allibone and Dr. Dunn was unexpected. It seems that they both at least agree, what they at least agree on is that changes in flow regimes present a risk of trout incursion into Galaxia's habitat. This is where the evidence for Fish and Game and Dr. Hayes and Mr. Trotter for Fish and Game is of interest. Dr. Hayes promotes a system whereby to set the flow changes expressed as percentages of the 7-day mean annual low flow are used as triggers for what is meant by no more than minor. And I want to pause there and note the footnote and observe that as I put to Mr. Hickey, the methodology for calculating 7-day MALF that Dr. Hayes described to the court is in fact the observed 7-day MALF and isn't the naturalised 7-day MALF that Fish and Game's legal submission seems to rely upon.
Pause there a second. I'm making a note. Okay, well, I hadn't appreciated the salience of that line of cross-examination. I do remember the cross-examination. I just didn't understand what its importance was to any issue to this case. So I will need to go back. This is the problem with not following cross-examination as it's unfolding.
I understand. And I want to just pause to develop that point a bit further because it's relevant to the Ngāti Rangi test.
Yeah.
Because if it's correct that the Ngāti Rangi approach is to be applied in assessing the Section 104D gateway, then that's the naturalised 7-day MALF threshold that's relevant to that exercise. Whereas if it's the observed, if it's the status quo environment is the comparator for the Section 104D effects gateway, then it would be more appropriate to use an observed 7-day MALF threshold. So it's not a matter that can simply be glossed over because how the gateway works is fundamentally different.
I'll read the evidence if we need to recall the witness. If the evidence is not clear on its face as a consequence of your cross-examination, I will recall the witness to understand the basis of his evidence better because I didn't understand at the time where that cross-examination was going.
Yes.
So let's hope that the transcript says what you are saying, but I certainly understand its application to Ngāti Rangi.
Yeah. Well, it may be that the court might find that because the witness intended it to be effectively a screening exercise for more work to be done, that you might come to the view that it's not appropriate to use it as a threshold for Section 104D anyway. But if the court is minded to apply it, as the legal submissions for the Fish and Game promote, that's when we need to drill down and understand exactly what it is that Dr. Hayes was proposing.
So if Fish and Game's case is that it's not merely a screening test where further work has to be done, which was Dr. Henderson's evidence when Ms. Irving was putting to him questions around the draft, I think, a discussion proposal for an NES, that seemed to be the thrust of his evidence, seemed to be also that his planning witness, he hadn't had contact with his planning witness to discuss how it was being picked up and applied in policy for this plan change. If it is something more than a rough screening, and therefore entry into a non-complying pathway, but more of a culling, if I could put it that way, on applications, your submission is it would not be appropriate to cull in this fashion because there's no real gateway.
Correct.
Is that what you're getting at?
That's the proposition. Mm. Mr. Hickey, in fairness yesterday, said that the thresholds have some utility in understanding the nature of the work that an applicant needs to do, but that's not Fish and Game's proposition. Fish and Game's proposition is that it's a proxy for what no more than minor means.
Is there a lot of assistance about how Mr. Farrell's redraft came out? Because it's right on this point. But I'm happy to not if that interrupts.
I would probably would like to continue with this case.
Yes.
And as I've indicated, I haven't actually read Mr. Farrell's evidence. But trying to, is it important for the court to know each party's theory of their case so that the court can understand the line of cross-examination and its salience to any case that is being pursued. So we'll endeavour to get to your evidence and to you after Mr. Page finishes, but only briefly, so that we are understanding where things are at.
Thank you.
Yes, I should say I haven't read Mr. Farrell's evidence either, so if I'm misrepresenting Fish and Game's case, then I apologise.
It may well be that the case has moved, so
yes.
So it's not a case of you misrepresenting anything. It's shifted because I think what you have said is probably right. It's more a culling. It's more not an actual gateway.
Yes.
Yeah. Not unlike what has been said about the non-complying policies which are attached to the non-complying activity as well. It's not actually a gateway for ORC.
Yes.
Yeah.
So if we come down to the middle of my paragraph 60, there is superficial attraction to Dr. Hayes' proposal. However, as discussed with him during cross-examination, his thresholds were not intended to apply as absolute, but rather as a threshold for more detailed assessment of the proposed flow regime. He also acknowledged that the application of the thresholds may enable trout incursion into critical galaxid habitat, which would result in more than minor effects. The issue will be explored further with Mr. Hickey, and of course it has been now, and also Dr. Olson when he is called. Of significance is Mr. Trotter's evidence where he explains the interaction between trout and galaxias. Mr. Trotter points out that such interaction can be managed through the installation of trout barriers and waterways where incursion presents a risk to existing galaxias habitat. The problem is that Mr. Trotter, nor any other Fish and Game witness, doesn't explain what the regulatory framework for installing trout barriers is. There is nothing in the controlled activity pathway that either requires or authorises the installation of trout barriers and waterways. It is a matter for DOC as the statutory manager of Indigenous freshwater species, Fish and Game as the statutory manager of salmonids, and the Otago Regional Council as regulator to deal with between themselves. Mr. Trotter's suggestions about how species interaction can be managed are useful and interesting, but really have nothing to do with the short-term permit mechanism or even the non-complying long-term permit proposal set out in Dr. Hayes's evidence. ORUG submits that the question of habitat management and species interaction is inherently a waterway-by-waterway exercise that needs to be tested against particular flow and allocation proposals. There is no one-size-fits-all solution to habitat protection and enhancement. It can only feasibly occur during the consent assessment process. ORUG says that the application process is the solution, and I should insert there to the Galaxid problem. It's not the solution to all problems. And that there should be an avenue for applicants to get on with dealing with it, and now. It is only through applications that the residual flows can be set for each tributary and each point of take that enables a careful analysis of species interaction to be carried out relative to specific flow proposals.
Can you just slow your pace down a little bit? And I just want to read that paragraph again.
The Kyburn Catchment Consenting Project is a good example of what can be achieved directly with the Department of Conservation and Ngārūnanga on Galaxias habitat protection through the resource consent process. Similarly, in the Lindis Permits reconsenting process, the court went to considerable lengths to devise methods to protect Galaxid habitat in the tributaries from trout incursion, and that's described in the fifth interim permits decision at paragraphs 36 to 49. Detailed arrangements of that kind are not contemplated by the controlled activity pathway in Plan Change 7 or by the National Objectives Framework under the NPS FM 2020.
Can you expand on your last comment or by Objectives Framework? What do you mean by that?
Well, the National Objectives Framework deals with FMUs and the values of FMUs, and so my submission is that the NOF process doesn't require the ORC to drill down to the level of each water body and each take permit to set attribute targets at each point.
So it doesn't require ORC to drill down to the level of each water body, and there was another each, what was that?
Yeah, and what the residual flows are required to achieve attribute targets at each take point. Certainly, attribute targets have to be set for FMUs, but the point I'm trying to make here is that the NOF process is inherently at a higher level than a resource consent process, which is much more site-specific. And one of the things that the court might take from Mr. Hickey's evidence yesterday is how site-specific the habitat issues are for Central Otago roundhead galaxids.
Paragraph 64.
It is implausible that the setting of residual flows and flow regimes and habitat management mechanisms for each waterway in Otago will be achieved through the Land and Water Regional Plan by December 2023. There is no evidence that the Council has devoted any resources to achieving that. It is, however, perfectly plausible that limits can be set for each waterway that is subject to replacement of deemed permits through the relevant consent process. Applicants know that they simply have to address the issue as a consequence of proposals to change flow regimes in each waterway. Returning to the Manaherikia catchment group example, a complex suite of minimum and residual flows has been proposed for the whole of the Manaherikia catchment to address precisely these issues, and the application is already before the Council. It is difficult to see why such a proposal should not come forward and be evaluated through the resource consent process. It is a first step towards restoring Te Mana o Te Wai. And the language in my last sentence is deliberate. ORUG does not say it is a complete answer to Te Mana o Te Wai, nor does ORUG say that the consent process can properly deal with all matters that are germane to the NPS. Its case is simply that setting limits now is a better expression of the NPS than not setting limits.
Deemed permits.
ORUG's primary submission is that there would be no need to carry over priorities if ORUG's relief, decline the plan change, is granted, since ORUG's position is that the transition from deemed permits to substantive RMA consents will adequately address water allocation issues between existing permit holders.
Just pause there a second. That submission, reject or decline the plan change, will mean that ORUG will pursue its application under the operative plan, correct?
Yes.
And under the operative plan, is it not left in the same, is it not in the same position where priorities mean something? Quite what it means, we've yet to hear from Council,
yeah.
But it means something.
Well,
and I'm not going to cut across your submissions because you already know that I want legal submissions on the points of law.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, so...
So the operative plan doesn't contemplate carrying over deemed permits, deemed priorities in the reconsenting of deemed permits. And that's what Mr Hickey explained yesterday, why the catchments have been moving to shared allocation regimes. As discussed with the court on Friday afternoon, the 19th of March, the applications being advanced by ORUG's expert witness team promote flow sharing agreements as the means by which groups of permit holders manage internal water allocation issues between them, instead of carrying over historic mining right priorities. The operative regional plan water anticipated a shift to a catchment-based water management group model to regulate water rationing through the adoption of policy 6412A to 6413 in the operative plan. The Council's principal reason for adopting policy 6413, which is the policy concerning the approval of rationing regimes, says this. This policy is adopted to enable the fair sharing of water under low flow conditions and to assist in delaying the wider suspension of takes.
Is this covered in your planning evidence or not?
No, I don't think so, ma'am.
Not in the planning evidence, so you're pointing us to provisions in the operative plan,
yeah.
Which may be relevant in terms of the administration of the operative plan and priorities, correct?
Well, the purpose of pointing out the flow sharing regime provisions is to understand how the operative plan was moving away from priorities.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, it's not in the planning evidence, so I don't think I have read it. So I do wish to read it, so as to understand what you are saying.
So it's Common Bundle Volume 1. In the Common Bundle page reference for 6412A is 99.
Just pause there, I'll just read it.
So the quote I've set out in my submissions is halfway down Common Bundle page 101 under the heading Principal Reason for Adopting Policy 6413.
Yeah. All right. So these are policies, for the record, 16.4.12A through to 6.4.12A through to 6.4.13, policies addressing water rationing, and your submission is these policies to subsume and or overtake priorities.
Yes, and so what I'm, the reason for pointing these out to the court is so that you understand the counterfactual. Plan change 7 being the proposition being tested and whether priorities need to be carried over.
Well, your witness says they do. So we're responding to what your planning witness says.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but
she is still saying carry over priorities.
Yes, I understand
that. So where are we going with
well,
this?
Well, I'm explaining to you why the reject the plan change relief is adopted,
what
the counterfactual is, which is the establishment of rationing regimes under the operative regional plan water, which was the phenomenon that Mr. Hickey was discussing with the court yesterday.
Just pause for a second. So I take you to mean that if the plan change is rejected, then holders of deemed permits, then the policies rather in the proposed plan as to water rationing would apply, subsume and overtake priorities.
Yes.
But because, but something else has to, but that's not the case if plan change is indeed approved by the court in some form. If it is approved by the court in some form, then the policies for water rationing obviously haven't come into Plan Change 7. So something else has to come into Plan Change 7. That something else is simply that priorities continue. Is that what your case is?
In relation to the controlled activity rule, yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
You will have, so that is one of the reasons why ORUG promotes a discretionary pathway, because that gives scope for water rationing regimes to come in.
Yes, just pause for a second. I'm making notes. You see, I thought, and I don't think it's an unreasonable thought, this would be all in the planning evidence, especially when the court raises the issues of why are priorities being carried over and there's no explanation in the planning evidence for that approach. This is an explanation for that approach.
The proposition for why priorities needed to be carried over was much more basic, which is simply that if the plan change is to preserve the status quo, then what are the elements of the status quo? Priorities seem to be part of that, and so there needs to be a mechanism to deal with it.
Except that the evidence from your own witness yesterday were that it was that water sharing agreements extinguish priorities. So it may well be, as a matter of law, that is the contractual arrangements as between members of that group, there are no priorities remaining. I don't know, but it's interesting that the mechanism is out there, and it's interesting that that mechanism is of interest to the court, not only in the context of a discretionary activity rule, which is where you say it attaches or bites, but also in the context of an alternative controlled activity rule.
But for the most part, the water rationing regimes that Mr. Hickey was describing yesterday are voluntary ones. There's no regulatory requirement to have them.
No, that makes them even a more intriguing animal to be dealing with, which is that either in a plan or in the context of a resource consent that you could bring them forward. But is that not what happened in Lindis? And they were conditioned up on the Lindis permits?
Yes, they have been conditioned up on the Lindis permits. Mm. But the discussion, Mr. Hickey's description of what's going on now is that catchments are effectively trialling what life looks like after 1 October 2021. Now, Plan Change 7 puts a fly in that ointment, because what life looks like after 1 October 2021 is not what they were envisaging, which is the transition to RMA consents that would have Lindis-style legal obligations to adopt water rationing regimes. Plan Change 7 throws that out the window for 6 years. Unless something can be brought into Plan Change 7 to enable catchments to move into the water sharing model for all of the benefits that Mr. Hickey was explaining.
I understand what your submission is.
Paragraph 68, the difference between such a regime, that is water sharing, and the system of deemed permits is stark. Deemed permits are prioritised in order of time, which reflects their genesis as private property rights. Water rationing under an improved water management group is centred on fairness and managing low flows. They are polar opposites. ORUG's members have been preparing to transition towards low flow water sharing. The Lindis permits decision is a case in point where the permits expressly require sharing agreements to be reached between permit holders to achieve defined objectives. The recent reconsenting of the Kyburn catchment, again endorsed by the Environment Court by consent order, is another example where that change in approach is used. The need to consider whether priorities may be carried over from deemed RMA permits issued under Plan Change 7 only arises because of the Regional Council's position that the status quo should be preserved until consent decisions can be made under the Land and Water Regional Plan. If that position finds favour with the court, then the court needs to know what the status quo is. The ORC's case does not attempt that analysis. It is the only party with the statutory duty and the power to collect the information. The starting point for the lawfulness of the deemed priority conditions is Section 413(2) of the Act. Priority conditions are deemed to be conditions of a deemed permit through reference to Section 11 of the Water and Soil Conservation Act and Section 413(2). This matter is also addressed with respect correctly in the legal submissions of counsel for the Director General. The next step, then, is whether deemed permit priority conditions are capable of being valid conditions on a resource consent issued under the Act. The test for validity is set out in Section 108AA. And the salient part is 1B. The condition is directly connected to one or both of the following: an adverse effect of the activity on the environment, or an applicable district or regional rule or national environmental standard. ORUG submits that there are two relevant effects of the activity on the environment that can satisfy 108AA 1B Romans 1. Firstly, an adverse effect on Tamana Otawai Tier 1 values of the river, where the higher priority permit is downstream of an upstream priority. Provision for downstream permits is the necessary function of a priority, since it would otherwise be unnecessary if the higher priority right was upstream of the other takes. That is, there will be no need to specify priority in that latter circumstance, since the upstream permit receives the water first anyway. Secondly, an effect on the environment where that environment includes other permit holders. Priority conditions serve an allocation function on a first-come, first-served basis so that progressive granting of permits upstream of previous permits does not have the effect of dewatering downstream permits. It is worth remembering that the mining permit regime allocated mining privileges, property rights, rather than statutory resource use rights.
Pause there a second. Have you got a section reference for that sentence? It's worth remembering. I mean, because it seems to me to be of critical importance, and I'd like to be able to trace it back into the legislation.
Not off the top of my head, ma'am.
Can you get back to me after lunch?
There's an earlier decision of the Environment Court sitting in this region. I think it's Department of Conservation and Otago Regional Council, where the history of mining privileges in Otago is traversed by the court, and that's where their genesis as property rights is discussed. I think it's referred to in one of my friend's submissions, that perhaps it's in the bundle somewhere, but I'll find it.
Yes. By 1 p.m, I want to know the provenance of that statement. It could well be the, I think it's the gold dredging case that you're referring to. Is that right?
It's a decision of the Environment Court when the operative regional plan water was before it.
Okay, now I'm thinking of another case.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, look, I want to know the provenance of that statement, because it's something that's troubling me. What is this creature of a priority? What's its nature? Is its nature in one of a private benefit as between permit holders, or is its nature one more properly considered in terms of addressing resource, resource management condition? And regardless of that answer, it may well be that it's appropriate now to recognise something in relation to priorities. Quite what that will do for the environment, I don't know, but I expect your witnesses will tell us. Quite what it'll do for your water sharing agreements, I don't know either. But whatever goes in has the potential now to cut across those water sharing agreements. And that's what your proposal is. That must be what your proposal is. Because if it comes in, it's no longer administered by water committees as between themselves.
Well,
for purposes which I understand are to regulate the take and use as between abstractors, but which might also now, according to Mr. Hickey, have a secondary or a primary environmental benefit or outcome.
Yes.
I don't know that, I haven't seen that. But accepting that that is the case, if you insert priorities, you will be cutting across the water sharing agreements. Now, that might be a satisfactory outcome, but being a betting person, I bet you it's not for farmers. So we'll explore, so again, you have to think, where does this go?
Well,
and we'll explore it with your witnesses.
Yes. Mm. My submission is that it needn't necessarily cut across water sharing agreements, because priorities exist now.
That's right, but they don't exist in a lineal arrangement across the water catchment, do they? They can, the highest priority, in other words, doesn't necessarily start at the top of the catchment. It can be at the bottom of the catchment, and priorities may shift up and down the catchment depending on their age.
Yes.
Now, you wouldn't need a flow-sharing agreement if you were untroubled by the priorities, or the priorities did indeed deliver to abstractors that which they were hoping to receive.
Yes. You'll recall Mr. Hickey yesterday said that the first function of a flow sharing agreement is to maintain a minimum flow.
Mm.
Now, of course, those minimum flows at the moment only exist on a voluntary basis in most of the catchments that would permits apply. So if as a consequence of Plan Change 7 there are no minimum flows brought in, the question arises about whether there is a continuing function for water sharing if there's no minimum flow to be maintained. Mm. The farmers have all been anticipating that minimum flows are coming and that they're going to have to learn how to manage themselves in relation to the minimum flows. And so the whole raison d'etre of water sharing agreements is predicated on minimum flows being imposed. That is not, it seems to me, now contemplated by Plan Change 7.
But what you asked the court to bring into Plan Change 7 are the existing priorities and the proposition, if you maintain that, and the proposition, which I'll explore with your witnesses, is whether it cuts across.
Yes.
The priorities will cut across, their individual exercise will cut across the flow sharing agreement. Because if it comes into the plan change as something which should be validly recognised in the plan change and by the regional council, now it will be for the regional council to administer, not for a water committee to administer.
Yes.
So that's the risk if you bring them in, that you're cutting across.
Yeah.
The work which is out there to secure minimum flows and is out there to secure flows for all abstractors.
Yeah, but remember that the ORUG's position is that it should get on and reconsent the catchments that its members are in. The issue of priorities only arises if the court says no, we simply want a rollover process for the next 6 years. That involves no substantive reconsenting and no imposition of minimum and residual flows. If that is the pathway, which is the purely procedural pathway for Plan Change 7, then ORUG's position is, right, fair enough, if that's what you're going to do, then please don't throw out the priorities because that changes what the status quo legal regime looks like.
Another pathway, which... the court is contemplating now because we have evidence in from your own witness, is whether or not the controlled activity pathway should as a matter of control, look at flow sharing arrangements which have already been entered into for catchments. In other words, not to contemplate that this is a mechanism only available under a discretionary activity, but is also a mechanism which may be available as a matter of control under a controlled activity rule.
Yes.
Now, I know that's not the relief that your client wants, because your client wants the opportunity to seek substantive consents for the next 20 years. I understand that. But the court has in mind, given the problems that priorities are like may engender to existing flow arrangements, that one of those matters of control, if the court is going to go down a controlled activity route, and no decision has been made, but one of those matters of control are flow sharing arrangements.
Yes.
As seen as they have been put into place as matters of policy and encouraged, farmers encouraged down this line.
Yes. Well, I'm not able to assist you here and now about how that might look in the control regime, but it's fair that you flagged that with us for so that our witnesses can assist you with that thinking.
Mm. All right. Anyway, 1 p.m. you'll come back in that mid-sentence. It's worth remembering priority mining permits, allocated mining privileges as property rights. I rather suspect you're right, but I want an authority for that.
Yes. The conversion from property rights model to the statutory resource use right under the Resource Management Act 1991 was a deliberate policy change brought about by the Act. Thus, for the priority rights to have been continued in a resource management regime, it must have been the case that Parliament intended that protection of priorities serve a resource allocation function as between existing right holders, again on a first-come, first-served basis. Conditions on water permits commonly contain limits, residual flow conditions, on the right to take water to avoid adversely affecting the ability of other resource users to take water. This is expressly recognised by the scope of restricted discretionary activity rules in Rule 12.1.4.8, Roman 17.
Just pause for a second.
Common Bundle, page 183.
So there, your submission is describing the RDA Rule 12.1.4.8 and the matter of discretion at Roman numerals 15, which reads whether the taking of water under a water permit should be restricted to allow for the exercise of another water permit.
Yes.
Okay.
This explains why ORUG is interested in the priority issue at all. If, during the Plan Change 7 regime, it is impermissible to grant consents that move from priority regimes to water-sharing regimes, then a means of allocating access to the resource permits... allocating access to the resource permit user... That doesn't make sense. Oh, it should be between permit users. Allocating the resource between permit users is required, otherwise chaos could reign.
Just pause for a second. Yes, and that's the matter that you and I have just been discussing,
yes.
Whether it is indeed impermissible
yes.
To grant consents that move from priority regimes to water sharing regime. That's obviously a key issue before the court.
It's live, yes.
Yep. And do you say it's impermissible? It's not in the plan change yet. That's why we're discussing it.
No, yeah. it's within the court's power to ensure that that happens,
okay.
But it's not part of the regional council's proposal.
Right. Okay, just a minute. All right.
This leads to the regional council's point that they neither monitor nor administer priority conditions on deemed permits. Whilst ORUG accepts that as a statement of fact, it is inconsistent with the council's duty to gather information, monitor and keep records under Section 35(2)(d). Be that as it may, Every permit holder has the right to apply to the Environment Court to enforce conditions of deemed permits. Section 314.1b, Romans 1, and Section 316.1. Such enforcement action might be civil in the sense of being between private persons rather than the consent authority, but it is nevertheless properly characterised as the enforcement of a public law statutory obligation rather than a civil obligation. There is no privity of contract or tortious obligation that would engage the jurisdiction of the High Court in its civil jurisdiction. If that is what is meant by Mr. De Peltsmaker as it being a civil matter. It seems that what Mr. De Peltsmaker really meant was that the Council simply isn't interested. With respect to the witness, the Council is obliged to be interested. Regardless, at a practical level, the existing priorities are things that, and I want to change the next line, rather than have given rise, I want to say have contributed to. Because Mr. Hickey was clear that in some circumstances priorities are really irrelevant, but in others they may be quite important. So that should, are things that have contributed to what we now see as the status quo. So if the status quo is to be maintained, then so must the priorities. At least I should say in some areas. But of course the Council isn't able to tell us which ones are which. But in any event, as an exercise of law, I submit that there is no legal impediment to priorities being carried over into the controlled activity rule if the Court is minded to do so.
So as a matter of law, there's no impediment
to carrying over the priorities into the controlled activity rule if the Court is minded to do so. And I'm not sure that Mr. Moore and I are actually apart on that point. Come to matters raised in submissions on behalf of other parties. Firstly, the question of derogation in the context of a consent review. Council Whanaurunanga submitted that the consent holders would resist material changes or reductions to takes or consented use on the basis of the non-derogation principle in Aoraki Water Trust and Meridian Energy. In Aoraki, the question before the High Court was whether permits could be granted to take water where the water was already fully allocated. The Court in Aoraki recognised the difference between that situation and a review under Section 128, where it said at paragraph 55, at the risk of stating the obvious, Section 128 is concerned with a very different situation from the one under consideration. The High Court at 41 of Aoraki also considered a consent authority is entitled to deliberately erode the grant of a resource consent when it is acting pursuant to specific statutory powers. It is submitted that the High Court clearly differentiated between the facts of Aoraki and the statutory review process pursuant to Section 128 of the Act. In light of this difference, it is difficult to see how the derogation principle would assist consent holders to resist material changes. Further, Section 128.2a, inserted by the Resource Management Amendment Act 2020, supports this interpretation. It expressly provides for consents to be reviewed together, presumably in order to allow the consistently and efficiently implement new limits across all affected consent holders. Turning now to the efficacy of the Section 128 review process. The High Court and Minister of Conservation and Tasman District Council considered sections 128 to 132 provided a comprehensive process for review, and that included reducing the scope of activity consented. In Genesis Power and Manawatu Whanganui Regional Council, the High Court rejected the unduly and restrictive view of the ambit of the powers given by the consent conditions review process of the court below. The High Court found that the consent condition review process to only be more limited than the consent process with respect to the Council's power to cancel. The Council has expressed discretion to review consent conditions on notice and modify them when a minimum or maximum level of or flow is set in an operative rule or regional plan, national environmental standard or national planning standard. The new land and water regional plan may set limits which the council is empowered to implement through the review process. The council may undertake a review of all affected water permits together rather than considering them individually. It is submitted that the consent review process has some significant advantages to the consent replacement process. Pursuant to section 128(2)(a), the council may review a full catchment together at the same time, allowing integrated implementation of new flow limits and or rates. This approach would enable a more comprehensive consideration of cumulative effects relative to the consent process, where the council must simply respond to the filing of applications by consent applicants. And the point I'm making in that last sentence for the court is that council has no control over who applies for what and when. It simply deals with things as they come in. And that is problematic from the point of view of coordinating the imposition of new limits in a catchment. By contrast, the section 128 enables the council to call in whole catchments at a time, and that is in fact what the ORC has been doing in other catchments before now.
Is this ability not open to the council through its preferred controlled activity route and the consenting of replacement consents for a period of 6 years? In other words, review after 6 years? When their new land and water plan is in place, or review after 20 years when the land and water plan is in place or something else is in place after that. In other words, whichever route you take, a 128 review is open.
A 128 review is open for certain.
Yeah. So what's the point you're making?
Well, my point is that when the method of implementing limits is requiring applications to reapply for consent, the ORC cannot control the sequence or order in which those applications are lodged or the order in which it makes decisions.
You mean when the method of implementing limits, i.e. limits under a new land and water plan, yep, when that comes into being, you can't... The ORC can't direct when those applications are to be filed.
Correct. For example, once Plan Change 7 is operative, applicants may begin... as the six-year permit term comes up, applicants are entirely free to lodge their applications whenever they like. For example, in the Lindis catchment, those applications were lodged years prior to the expiry of their permits. Other applicants might wait for the last day. And so you've got the whole case law around the sequence and timing of when applications have to be heard and determined, over which the ORC has no control whatsoever. Yet, as an authority initiating a review under Section 128, it can call on every permit in the catchment and deal with them at the same time as an integrated whole.
Are you going to address in your submission whether and to what extent the ORC under 128 can address over-allocation in where this is found in a future land and water plan in respect of the attributes which are described in the MPS.
Well, there's an express power in section 128 to do that.
Which power's that?
Section 128, 1B, Romans 1.
I don't know. Just getting into it. Nearly there.
Else fails, I have a hard copy of the section.
All right, okay, so 128, 1, 1B, Roman numerals 1.
Yes.
And I'll just read it. And your submission is presumably, if there is over-allocation, as found to be over-allocation, then the permits can be reviewed in line of any rule that relates to maximum and minimum level or flow rates or use of water, so that's one category, or minimum standards of water quality. That would be the second relevant category, correct?
Yes. And this paragraph was introduced by the Resource Management Amendment Act 2020.
All right, thank you.
So my submission about that is that subsection of Section 128 arrived on the statute books at the same time as the NPSFM 2020 was being promulgated. So we need to see the NPS and that power as companion provisions.
What is the minimum standard of water quality? Is that a term which or phrase which is defined by the Act or not?
Not that I'm aware of.
Does that... how would you interpret that? Is that to be interpreted in relation to the national bottom lines or something other than the national bottom lines?
Well, it's a reference to a rule and a plan rather than a provision of the NPS.
Mm.
So how the NPS environmental outcomes are expressed in the plan will be important so that we know whether they are a minimum standard of water quality. So I would have thought that if the national bottom lines are carried through into a as a rule into the regional plan, that they would certainly qualify. Just to postulate an example, suppose through the Land and Water Regional Plan, the allocation block for a particular water body was 1,000 litres a second. Just for the simplicity of maths. If the allocation of that 1,000 litres per second was on a first-come, first-served basis, then the regional council would have real difficulty addressing questions of equity if applications were allowed to come in one at a time in whatever sequence applicants chose. And there would be nothing preventing the first applicant chewing up that allocation block, whereas a whole of catchment review under section 128(2)(a) can deal with that allocation block at the same time with the whole of the catchment. And so ORUG's position is that far from Mr. De Peltmaker's concerns about efficacy, there is in real terms major advantages to the Section 128 review process being the way in which limits which appear in the regional, the Land and Water Regional Plan are implemented. And the court will remember that that's exactly how the operative regional plan water works, because there's a policy framework addressing the implementation of minimum flows on a whole of catchment review.
Does your, in terms of the importance or value of a 128 review process that you're describing, is that not predicated on... What's that predicated on? What's the underlying assumption here that all resource consents are granted and expire in the same broad period? Is that one assumption? Or all resource consents can be granted for any period or many periods, but are just simply reviewed at the same time? Is that the other assumption? An assumption which is unstated. What is it?
Well, in fact... the Section 128 power overcomes the need to make any assumptions about that, because the term of the permit is irrelevant to the Council's power to review it.
Yeah. Where, so then why, again, why is this only available on a six-year duration? Which is, you know, under, why is this not available to the Council should short-term consents... be issued via the controlled activity or potentially longer consents under the non-complying activity route?
Well,
why is it not available?
Well, I mean, the power is always available.
It's always available.
Yes.
Yeah.
But the underlying...
Assumption
in the Council's case in favour of Plan Change 7 is that all consents should expire in 6 years' time so that... the Land and Water Regional Plan can be implemented through the process of reapplication. ORUG's case is that that's fundamentally misconceived, that the better way to implement the Land and Water Regional Plan is through whole of catchment reviews under Section 128(2)(A). And if the court accepts that that power is apt to achieve the outcome, there is simply no need to cut off all reconsenting on a six-year time frame.
But as matters stand, there is nothing preventing ORC from reviewing the whole catchment at the same time, even if short-term consents were granted.
Correct.
Correct. Understood. Understand what your argument was, isn't it?
I want to come to the question of viability under Section 131. Fish and Game submitted that the assessment of effects on review is fundamentally different to the assessment required for a replacement consent. With respect, we disagree. The Council's assessment in relation to the consent review process is bounded by Section 131, which requires the Council to have regard to the matters in Section 104, which of course includes 104.2a, which is the investment in infrastructure. And secondly, whether the activity allowed by the consent will continue to be viable after the change. In addition, the Council may have regard to the manner in which the consent has been used. In Davis and Gisborne District Council, the case demonstrates that the Section 131 assessment in relation to a consent condition review process assessing noise effects caused by the operation of a gun club. The viability analysis was conducted separately from the Section 104 analysis in this decision. Viability was held not to turn on the financial capacity of the gun club to take mitigating steps where there was an option to avoid activities altogether. Unlike Section 104.2a, the value of investment was not the driving consideration. Rather, the viability incorporated an assessment of the impact, including costs, of the changes on the ability of the consent holder to continue the activity while addressing the unreasonable noise effects. Viability incorporates more than the value of the investment made by the consent holder. Viability is a more prospective inquiry directed at the effect of the change on the ability of the consent holder to continue the activity. Equally, the assessment must not assume that the consent holder can continue to operate as they had done prior to review. In Davis, the court was not swayed by the financial ability of the consent holder to respond to the reviewed conditions. The court found that the consideration was subservient to the statutory obligations to avoid unreasonable noise and achieve the purpose of the Act. It is therefore submitted that the concerns raised by Ngāi Fish and Game in the ORC as to the limited utility of the Section 128 reviews process is unfounded. So I offer Davis as an example where, despite complaints about viability being advanced by the gun club in that case, the court held, yes, we've had regard to that, but it's the tail mustn't wag the dog. The primary consideration was the Section 16 duty and achieving the purpose of the Act. And you can see the potential similarity here. If an irrigator says, well, my investment in irrigation would be stranded, or the viability of the farm after a limit is imposed might be imperiled, those are, of course, relevant considerations to have regard to. But if fundamentally carrying on as they were is inconsistent with the NPS, then that's a higher order consideration.
The issue wouldn't, though, be one of fundamentally inconsistent with the NPS. The issue would be one of fundamentally inconsistent with the future land and water plan. Is that not so? Because you'd be
Yes, but if the implementation of the land and water plan is the expression of the NPS, which is the expression of Part 2, then it is difficult to escape an argument that achievement of new rules in a plan isn't a higher order consideration. Effectively, we're saying that the ORC is being far too timid here about the extent of their powers under Section 128.
The promulgation of that new plan, would that not also bring into account, or should bring to account, considerations as to the investment in infrastructure and viability of existing farm programs when deciding whether and how to manage in the short, medium, then long term those the goals of the particular plan in relation to the compulsory the compulsory values and discretionary values and the outcomes for the same. In other words, the same issue arises in relation to the promulgation of the plan, and that's where it is addressed. So it's not really under a new plan, whilst applicants might say under a 128, yes, but that's going to affect my viability. That question should have already have been considered by the decision maker in relation to the new plan. Is that not so?
Yes, that's so. Well, I'm not sure that those issues affect the environmental outcomes.
It affects the timing and sequencing of the environmental outcomes. So instead of saying, well, you know, you've got 5 years to get your nutrients under control and to lift the game above the national bottom lines, just say, hypothetically, if that's the issue, it might be 10 years because of the investment and sunk already into the infrastructure.
Yes, and that stepwise process is my understanding of the requirements that the NPS creates for the adoption of a new regional policy statement. The timeframes by which those targets are achieved is a matter that the RPS deals with. And that will be picked up through the Land and Water Regional Plan.
The RPS is dealing with the timeframes for the attainment of those compulsory values and other discretionary values?
No, it deals with the attainment of the long-term visions for the FMUs and how Te Mana o Te Wai is going to be achieved.
Hmm. Well, time for a cup of tea. And we'll think about that before moving on to Ms. Dixon's witness.
Thank you.
Okay.
All rise.